the crop.
Hello, and a big welcome to the Gooner podcast. This is number 133, which was done after the total shambles that was Stoke away from home. I'm Mark Hollington, and I'm your host for the second month on the spin. It's like that awful bad smell you get around White Hart Lane. I'm back. But our panel better be ready, as I will try and poke and probe them more than a rude online video. And speaking of the panel, what a meeting of minds we had for this month. I'm expecting great things from such a cavalcade of Arsenal knowledge. First up, an esteemed gentleman is a long-term Gooner writer and an Arsenal shareholder to boot. He often puts pen to paper on ownership or general football issues. And fact fans, he has been going to Arsenal games since the late 60s. Interesting. With this knowledge, experience and dedication, I'm expecting to hear good, solid debate and a balanced view. Are you listening, Steve Ashford? It's a big Gooner podcast welcome to the man they call Bernard Dowling. Hello, Bernard.
Hello. Thanks.
Next up is someone who may have hosted this pod for years and years, but as loyal listeners know, spent most of his time butting in and telling us his views anyway. One of his most famous views was that Nicholas Barry Bendler would one day be World Footballer of the Year. Who knows? It may still happen. But while we wait, what better to have the man behind such incisive football knowledge here with us on this panel? It is the legend that is David Udo. Hello, David.
Hello, Mark. Hello, everyone.
Excellent. And last, but never least, is the editor of this esteemed organ, the Gooner. He is back for the second month on the trot, mainly because somebody else on the panel couldn't make it. But that matters not one jot. People love this guy, as he always says what he means, and he holds no punches. It's top-selling author, an all-round good egg, my boss, Kevin Witcher.
Hello, viewers, and I'm honoured to be on the panel with a character I shall in future refer to as the Illustrated Man after the Rod Steiger movie. Look it up, fact fans.
My word, I have no idea what Kev means, but he's very intelligent, do as he says. Just like last month, you dudes at home have been helping set the very topics via Twitter, so thank you very much for that. And speaking of Twitter, have you heard that, David, they're making a film version of the Twitter story?
No, go on.
They had to cancel a very big scene that featured thousands of people. It wasn't the cost of the extras that actually stopped it happening. They were very strict. They could only have 145 characters.
Oh,
I made that up today. Anyway,
it's 140.
It's 140.
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Mere details. This is called comedy in action. Make it up as I go along. You know, you don't get this from other hosts. Anyway, you don't get this from that guy. What's he called? Alan Davis. We probably do because he's that comedian. Anyway, I digress. Your tweets are coming up, so thank you very much for them. But let's start with the game against Stoke. David Udo, I'll start with you. What happened?
What happened? Sadly, what everyone expected from a certain point of view. I mean, we had a good three games prior to that, and maybe we were thinking, in the words of Yazoo and her plastic population, that the only way is up. But when you're playing against a team who have had Peter Crouch on the bench for the best part of 3 months, know that they're playing Arsenal, think, hang on, this lot can't defend. We've got a guy who can head and attack. Okay, Peter, let's wheel you in. I mean, Arsenal shoot themselves, and for us to be one down in less than a minute and a half, I mean, at that point, it was kind of game over, really. It was sadly slightly expected from a certain point of view, but oh dear God, being 3-0 down against a team built around the likes of Jonathan Walters, who's A, Scouse, and B, can't get anywhere near the Liverpool or Everton teams. They're playing Peter Crouch with his first start in months. It was woeful, embarrassing. Yeah, we had a second half. We pulled back to two goals. Hurrah for us. Hurrah for us. A make-believe penalty. And Ramsey swinging his leg with his eyes closed. But even then, I didn't really think we were going to get an equaliser. So whilst it was a huge disappointment and we were woeful and we defended... Well, I think we defended. I don't think it actually comes within the definition of the word in any language. But part of me saw it coming.
Bernard, did you have a similar view before the match? Or did you expect to win after the three wins that we had?
No, I wasn't. We always struggle at Stoke, and I think yesterday's game reflected Wenger's philosophy in as much that he's not that interested in defending anymore. I find it remarkable. This is the guy that put Vieira and Petit in the same midfield together. And now, when your first choice defensive midfielder is Arteta, with Flaminia's backup, things aren't going to be the same. Defensively in midfield, we're simply not good enough, and defensively at the back, we're not good enough. I'm not yet convinced whether it even bothers Wenger, because I think he would much rather draw a game 3-3, Anderlecht would have been much better for him than drawing 0-0. You know, he's not interested in defending anymore. And yeah, I think conceding three goals in the first half yesterday reflected his current philosophy about the game, and it's changed from what it was when he first came here and enjoyed such success during the time the club played at Highbury. Things have gone backwards defensively since the move to the Emirates. Full stop.
Kev, we know your views on Mr. Wenger, so perhaps we're kind of get that, but focus on the actual game itself. The second half was a vast improvement on the first half. So what does that say about the team, the way they kind of set out their stall at the start of the game? Do they take it not seriously enough?
Well, they just didn't fancy it. I mean, physically, they were losing every challenge. I mean, the statistic that Match of the Day read out a few hours later was that the defence between them won a single tackle over 90 minutes, which basically is indicative of that they didn't really want to get in there and challenge on a physical level. And that's a huge part of the problem with the current Arsenal. They're not strong enough. I mean, it's this experiment a few years ago which to turn us into a version of Barcelona. And it sort of changed the psychological makeup of the team. And in spite of having players who are battlers, there aren't enough of them. And the team as a whole kind of sinks together. You can tell by the body language once in the old days, Arsenal might go a goal down and they'd come roaring back. Now we go a goal down, we go three goals down not too much later. And the lack of response is indicative of I think the way that the players are pretty much in a bubble. They're secure, they're not hungry. I mean, they're so well rewarded now for effectively achieving the bare minimum they should, it's interesting, the only player that seems to demonstrate genuine desire in a team is a guy who hasn't been there very long and has come from a background very different from most of his colleagues, where he genuinely did have it hard. Now, whether or not eventually he will lose interest as well, we don't know, but the marked difference between his attitude and that of his teammates is obvious, and it's actually a condemnation of his colleagues, I'm afraid. They should be embarrassed sometimes to be on the same pitch as Sanchez.
Bernard, you mentioned the defence, and Wenger doesn't really, you know, see defence as perhaps a vital part of the game.
Yeah.
Do you think any of our current back four are worthy of a title-winning team?
I think Mertesacker and Koscielny need each other. When one of them isn't playing, I don't think the other left in the team is anything like as impressive as they are when they play together. So together, I'd say the central defence is just about good enough. But when one of them's missing, no way. Gibbs. He reminds me of Clichy. I think he shows promise, but hasn't really reached the level that I was certainly expecting him to when he first came into the team. And I'd say make the same point about Gael Clichy. That's why I almost came out with Clichy's name. Debussy started very well, and I think he would be good enough, but we haven't seen much of him. In reserve, you don't get a player of the similar standard. But, you know, I think Debussy started very well. As long as he'd have maintained that sort of level, I think he could be good enough. The question is, will he maintain that level? But I'm confident about him. But Kieran Gibbs, I've got doubts about, and Murta Sacker and Koscielny are fine as long as they're together.
Yeah, but Dave, I mean, good points Bernard makes, but we did keep three clean sheets in our previous matches against Dortmund, West Brom, Southampton. Was that luck? Was the defence playing better in those matches? Or was it the simple fact that Lauren Koscielny was actually playing?
I think Koscielny being back in the latter two of those games was definitely a huge factor. I mean, Borussia Dortmund are what they are. They are bottom of the Bundesliga. So that game is kind of a moot game, I suppose. But I mean, Koscielny and Mertesacker, individually, I don't think they're brilliant players, but they really do bring the best out of each other. But as we saw on Saturday, well, you may have noticed on Saturday, but even though Chambers was filling in at centre half for the first time in God knows how long, Mertesacker was pushed to the left hand side of the two centre halves with Chambers on the right, when normally it's Koscielny on the left and Mertesacker on the right, or Monreal on the left, Mertesacker on the right. Mertesacker is the right hand sided centre half. So within 80 seconds of the first game, he's thrown on the left hand side, he's caught 10 yards out of position because essentially it is like being in a different position. And, you know, we go a goal down. So we shot ourselves in the foot. I mean, Mertesacker and Koscielny, like I said, I don't think they're brilliant centre-halves at all. I mean, Koscielny, I think he's the fourth-choice international centre-half for France, and he can't get in the team ahead of Sacco, who's the fourth-choice Liverpool centre-half, even when he's fit. And Mertesacker's retired from international football, but they're bringing the best out of each other. Without one or the other, we're fudged. I mean, look at the start of last season. We only had three centre-halves on the senior professional staff. A couple were injured in the first game. We had to play Bakary Sagna at centre-half, and we lost 3-1 at home to Villa. Surely at that point, you think that's going to raise an issue. So what does Wenger do? He sells one of those three centre-halves and does not replace them. Fail.
Indeed, David, indeed. Before we move on to, I guess, the main topic of today, and it's always the main topic, Mr. Wenger, let's talk about the keeper. We've mentioned the defence. Martinez kept a few clean sheets and then obviously had an arguably more difficult game against them. Stoke. A serious keeper, is he a potential option?
I think the only answer one can give is I don't know, because he looked very good in his first couple of games, but I can't think of a single shot he had to save in those games. You know, he looked good at catching the ball, his distribution was good, he looked fairly commanding across the area, but saving a shot, I had no idea what he was like. And it was interesting, you know, the first minute yesterday, it's wrong to criticise him for the goal, but I think he made it easy for Crouch because he dived out the way of the ball. You know, he was leaping across to one post, leaving a Crouch with a simple tap in the other side. So Martinez, I don't know, you know, what his shot stopping is going to be like. If it's as good as the rest of his game, I'd say yes, but I don't see how one can answer that yet. Who knows?
Indeed, the writing is still yet to be written or something like that. Let's get on to the main topic. Davey Boyd here tweeted in, and he's, Kevin, I'll give this one to you. Serious question. When do you think the tide turned against Wenger? So he's implying pretty much that it's most Arsenal fans are now anti-Wenger. And I think we would pretty much say that was true, though, right?
Well, certainly, if you look at the polls in the national newspapers, the majority would prefer a new manager. So on that level, yes, I think it was about low 60s to high 30s the last time there was a poll done. Might have been the Mirror, I can't remember.
What do you think the tipping point was then, Kevin?
I think the frustration this season. Because, obviously, when Wenger signed on for three more years, he just won the FA Cup. People knew he had money to spend. There was a real feel-good thing about Arsenal in the air. So much so that, in a sense, the defeats against the likes of Chelsea and Liverpool last season had kind of been brushed under the carpet, because people were just so happy about winning a trophy. It had been a long time. So there was forgiveness in the air. Yes, Arsene, you can win us trophies. But on the back of that, with another 3 years, people thought, OK, so we've got money now. You know, we don't have those excuses now. Let's push on. And because he's made the same mistakes he has been making for several seasons, people realise that actually nothing's going to change and Arsenal are not going to compete for the league title again under this manager. And it is Wenger's fault at the end of the day, because Wenger is in charge of transfer policy. Wenger decides how many players he needs in each position, and few would argue that we're not strong enough at the back and in terms of defensive midfield. They knew that last season. You know, this isn't exactly new. But he didn't rectify it. So, on top of that, the apparent continuation of the gung-ho gunners, whereby tactically we are all over the shop chasing goals and looking like a Sunday league team, has just frustrated people so much. And I think most people were prepared to give Wenger a chance, and now they actually realise that he's had enough chances. Nothing's going to change. And it's just sheer frustration because he hasn't learnt. And the thing is, why would he have learnt anyway at his age? Why is he going to change now? You know, he is an old man. He's set in his ways. He does things his way, and that now isn't good enough.
No.
And unfortunately, people are just fed up now.
Alex Ferguson, red-faced buffoon that he was, he did though. He was adaptable, wasn't he? He was an old guy, going different coaching methods, different assistant managers, regularly refreshed the backroom staff. Why could he do it and not Wenger?
Because he'd always been doing it. He'd done it throughout his career, so he didn't change. He was still set in his ways, but his ways were actually appropriate. Wenger has settled on one way of doing things, and because initially it was very successful, he's continued doing it. That way of doing things being trust the players to work it out themselves. Now, that's okay if you've got a certain calibre of player who's actually been coached properly and developed by others, who then comes under Wenger and basically takes on the best of Wenger, but also has something in themselves which can make them winners. So, for example, I was reading an extract from Amy Lawrence's book about Ashley Cole, whereby it was Lee Dixon saying what happened with Cole. Basically, he couldn't defend.
Just here, a perfect example of that is Ashley Cole. He couldn't defend to save his life when he got into the Arsenal team, but he'd argue one of the best coaches in Tony Adams standing next to him.
And this is why Wenger was successful in his early years, because he inherited players who were able to basically sort things out defensively on the pitch. So it's significant that obviously he talks about Vieira and Petit earlier, and they were sorted out by the defenders behind them, instructed what was required, and they adapted. Now, it wasn't something Wenger did.
I think in that same book, Vieira even said to Sol Campbell, if I get lazy or I switch off, you shout at me and you tell me to get back and do that.
Well, this is the other point about fans who are still support Arsene claim that he built a defence without the famous back five. Now, my argument to this is he got lucky with Campbell. So basically, once Adams retired, he had there Campbell and as well as Keown. Keown wasn't playing all the time, but Keown was involved. And Cole had been developed partially by Adams. So Kolo Touré came in. Now, he was operated by Campbell.
Yeah.
And Lauren, fortunately, had the intelligence to actually play right back and adapt his own game. And because he was such a battler, he wasn't actually a brilliant defender, but he was such a battler that he became part of a very good back four. So in that sense, after the famous back five more or less retired, he was able to keep it going for another three seasons, mainly due to Sol Campbell. But since effectively Campbell left the club, defensively we've never been sound. And Wenger is not able to do a good defence, and he's not going to be able to recapture that now. So it's a long-term Achilles heel of the manager. And it was masked because of basically the setup when he came in. And it was able to continue. And credit to Wenger for keeping those defenders going for so long. You know, Adams played under Wenger for almost 6 years and played very well. But, you know, at the end of the day, they couldn't last forever. So effectively, Wenger's fortune ran out with that, as did the trophies at the same time.
Kev raised some very good points there, Dave. Mm. And some fans would argue that whilst Wenger never did tactics, he did have a plan. Kev then mentioned Petit and Vieira. Having those two was a plan. Whereas now, what is the plan? No one's actually quite, I'm sure. So two questions to you. Does Wenger actually really know what he's doing? What is his vision? And do you support Wenger? And if so, or if not, when was that tipping point, if you aren't?
His plan for this season, I don't think he knows himself, because if anyone can tell us exactly what our choice of formation is, I'll be quite surprised, because either I'm drinking too much Bovril before games, or the team's slowed all over the place. Because in games this year, we started at 4-1-4-1, then it appears to become a 4-3-3, but then we go back to a 4-2-3-1, and for 11 seconds we go 4-4-2. So it's either no discipline within the team. They are allowed to run wherever they want to in front of the back five, apart from Arteta or Flamini, who does have to sit there as a pivot. So I think you've got that issue. I mean, when everybody's fit, sorry. But when everyone's fit, I mean, nobody knows what 11 players are going to put out. Nobody knows what formation they're going to be in. I think that's a huge problem. With regards to how I feel about Arsene Wenger,
yeah,
I've not had any faith in him for quite some time. I had some patience when we moved to the new ground, because let's face it, there was going to be a massive mortgage and purses were going to tighten. We knew that, and that was what the club and the then CEO, Keith Edelman, essentially came out and said. And it was like, okay, we're all in this together. For the last 4 years, we've been told that everything's okay. We've also been told that there are no American troops in Baghdad. And read my lips, I did not have sexual relationships with that woman, over and over again. If you're being told one thing and something else is happening, you just lose faith in it. And the impression I'm given is that whereas in most football clubs in the Premier League, you have the CEO and or director of football who are in charge of transfers. Apparently, according to the AGM I went to this year, Wenger signs off on everything, apart from the contracts itself physically, which are done by Gazidis as the authorised signatory, but that's subject to Wenger's approval. He does too much, and he does it quite poorly. We buy poor players. The team sets up in a multitude of different formations in the same game. They don't talk to each other on the pitch. We run around all over the place. It's sheer disorganisation. And even though Jurgen Klopp has got Borussia Dortmund at the rock bottom of Bundesliga, I'll take him, I'll take Roberto Martinez, I'd consider Owen Coyle.
Bernard, I've read your articles for many a year. You're a man that's a bit more of a voice of reason. I like to think of you as perhaps not being as emotive as David there. Has it been a tipping point for you, or are you still backing Wenger?
No, I'm not backing Wenger, and I haven't for quite some while. My problem with him really started... I spoke about a change in philosophy earlier. I think a reflection of that change in philosophy was that he decided he wanted to play like Barcelona, because I heard him give an interview some while ago when he expressed his gratitude to Spanish football for convincing him power and strength wasn't needed in midfield anymore. I think that was his single worst decision as Arsenal manager. I don't care whether he's bought duds like Jeffers, Arshavin didn't work, Squillaci, Silvestre. Every manager does that. I can go with that. But for me, his single worst decision was moving away from this idea that you had to have power and size in midfield. Because I mentioned, first of all, this is the guy that brought Vieira and Petit together in the same midfield. And, you know, now he plays with a bunch of midgets in midfield. And it just doesn't work for the English game. I'm not even convinced that Barcelona would have had the success playing in the Premiership that they had in La Liga. So for Wenger to say how grateful he is to Spanish football for making him decide that power and strength wasn't needed in midfield, for me, is the worst decision of his career, and since he made that decision, I've had little or no faith in him. The FA Cup win last season was great, thoroughly enjoyable, but it was a temporary blip in an otherwise blemished record in the recent few years.
It's very interesting that, Bernard. I've just been handed this quote from our top research team here, and this is from Pep Guardiola, current Bayern Munich manager, and he put, "I loathe all that passing for the sake of it, all that ticker-tacker. It's so much rubbish and has no purpose. You have to pass the ball with a clear intention, with the aim of making it into the opposition's goal. It's not about passing for the sake of it." So perhaps Wenger got the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
Which you could say, right? I mean, let's face it. You know, we have done tiki-taka for quite a while. And would you say...
Yes, but we haven't done the other side of what Barcelona do.
And that's what you're saying, isn't it? We haven't had that incisiveness and that directness to score a goal.
We certainly haven't gone, Bernard.
Yeah, I mean, what Barcelona and now Bayern Munich do with their shorter passing game is press the opposition. Mm. Yeah, Arsenal don't do that to any great extent. You know, the opposition get the ball and they're left to it to see what they can do. You know, with our short passing game, we have 40 ball passing movements without getting into the opposition half. You know, it's also pointless. You know, you can keep possession for 10 minutes and go nowhere. And I think that's the way Arsenal play this game. And it isn't the way Barcelona play it. And indeed Bayern Munich.
Well, I think we're all agreed here, all three panellists, and even me as a host. You know, I'm turning to David now, giving my views, but, you know, we're probably on the side of being thinking it's the right time for Wenger to potentially go. But is that right? When we look at the abuse he got from those fans at the train station the other day, being very widespread across the media, for those of you that don't know, there's a video clip doing the rounds when it's just some fans shout abuse at Wenger, tell Joel Campbell to leave the club because it's time to get out. Pretty harsh stuff. And the guy's getting it. Is he right to get that type of stuff from fans? And if not, how do fans get their voices heard? I'll start with you there, Kevin.
Well, it's very ugly to see. Is it right? Not really, no. But you've got to ask the questions, how do people reach those lengths? And how the club allowed it to reach those lengths? Because ultimately, any other manager at any other club would not have lasted 8 years without winning a trophy, especially unless I'm talking about clubs of Arsenal stature. But even if you actually go down the ranks, probably all four divisions, what a club demands is progress. They demand some sign that things can improve. Now the problem at Arsenal is that we've reached a level where the directors and the owner are happy. They're content. They've got a different set of ambitions from the supporters. What the supporters want to see is improvement upon finishing fourth place every year. And that it would mean challenging for the title. Season long, not giving up the ghost after two-thirds. And because of the consistent lack of ability to deliver anything that looks like progress, people have just got frustrated and they end up in these nasty scenes where even Wenger shouldn't be in this position.
No.
You know, Wenger should have been let go. You know, there was a wonderful opportunity for him to just bow out on a high last summer. But the board are so happy with the continued Champions League qualification. They think he's a safe bet. He's delivering them profit. He's delivering them a full stadium. In a way, we as supporters are equally as guilty for continuing to buy the season tickets. But this is a problem. It's like a drug, you know.
Yeah.
It's like heroin or something. You know, there's so many people in that stadium who are not happy, but they just won't give up the season ticket. Now, perhaps an organised protest might come along where the people who aren't happy all decide they won't attend a particular game. Maybe there might be a match where there's only 30,000 people there. I don't know. But, you know, that would be a way in which people who really want to express their discontent but don't want to give up their season tickets could make a statement. There are other ways that can be done. But yeah, I mean, basically, it was horrible to witness.
Yeah.
No one likes that. But, you know, the people who actually were booing there had paid money to go up to Stoke to watch the team. So you can't say they're like fly-by-nights, they don't care about Arsenal. You know, they invest time and money to follow the team, and they were justifiably unhappy. Should it have turned into that? Regrettably, it did, but I wish it hadn't.
Yeah. David, I don't go to many away matches anymore, but my brother, who does a lot, tells me that he's seeing more and more unrest and fights breaking out between Arsenal fans, because all those supporters that still do back Wenger, you know, let's be honest here, there are a lot of our listeners out there that want him to stay as manager. But when our fans in the press are fighting each other, are we making ourselves a laughing stock of football? Are people looking at us going, those spoiled bunch of bastards?
Oh, this nature of us being a spoiled bunch of bastards, I don't think people from the outside looking in really get it. It's not that we're thinking we are Arsenal, therefore we deserve everything. And this whole nature of we're finishing fourth every year and qualifying for the Champions League, what more do you want? That's a trophy, isn't it? Well, no, it's not. It's not. You know, why do people get involved with football? I mean, I was brought up by an Arsenal family, and I just want to see Arsenal win as much as they can. The thing that frustrates Arsenal fans the most is that we pay more for our matchday tickets and our season tickets than any other entity in world football, actually in world sport. You can get a season ticket at a Major League Baseball club in America for under $1,000, and they play 82 home games a season. So you get an awful lot more value for money. The thing is, we put in more money than anyone else, and that money just sits there in the bank account, and we're not buying the players that we want. And then you see the team go out, we play at about 5 miles an hour, we play a game whereby if you get 80% possession, the manager seems to think they get you some kind of magical, mystical point or something. But the players go off at half-time without breaking a sweat. I don't think I've ever been more proud as an Arsenal fan than the end of the 2006 European Cup final, because when the final whistle went, you saw our 10 players on the pitch completely prostrate because they'd given as much as they possibly can and they physically couldn't stand up. I've never been so proud in my life. Whereas now, part of me thinks this club is so tight, they tell the players not to run around so much because that way we don't have to launder the kit and therefore we save a little bit of money. It's, you know, it's like Arsenal are owned by Northern and Shell or something.
Or spend a little bit less money on Lucas or something.
Exactly. Exactly. If the players, the manager, the club itself put everything in as much as it possibly could to try and win something, and we failed, at least I'd be proud. But the thing is, we're shooting ourselves in the foot and we're not trying as hard as we possibly can, and we as the supporters are being cheated. But what is the club's thinking? I remember something the Gazeta said at the AGM this year with regards to Arsenal ticket prices, and essentially saying it's going to go up again at the end of this season. From where I'm sitting, demand exceeds supply. So even if you've been going, Mr. Downing, you've been going to Arsenal for nearly 50 years now, if at the end of this year you write a letter and say, I choose not to renew my season ticket, shame on all of you. Will Gazidis cry a tear? Will he say, next?
Yeah, it'll go on to the next person on the waiting list.
Of course it will. So that's why you've got this fight now amongst Arsenal fans, because we're restraining ourselves. And for people to say, no, have faith in this, I'm sure that the 7 years they've been involved with this football club, you know, we're just getting what we had when they started. But we're not the same club as we were when we were a football club. Now we're a sporting entity.
Bernard, I'm not saying that you're old, but as you mentioned, you've been going for many a year now. And you've seen Arsenal for some very lean times back in the day.
Yeah.
You were there for the early 80s,
yeah.
Terry Neill.
Yeah.
Back in those times, can you ever recall any kind of time where the support was so against one another, the Arsenal support, and so fractious?
No, because even during the end of Terry Neill's time, I think it was a bigger majority wanted him out. You know, it was very, very hard to find anybody that wanted Terry Neill to continue in the post. With Arsene Wenger, I think it is more split, although it's now a comfortable majority in favour of wanting him out. But there are still a lot of people who think the sun shines out of his backside still. And I think he's living on his past in the years when he managed the club at Highbury. If he'd have taken over in 2006 when Arsenal moved stadiums and he was still there and we'd done exactly the same since that date as we have, everybody would be wanting him out, even to a bigger extent. They wanted Terry Neill out back in 83 or whenever it was. I will go back to the criticism he got boarding the train at Stoke as well, because while it was unfortunate and I didn't enjoy seeing it, a point I will make is that he earns the money to expect that kind of treatment when things go badly for the team on the pitch. You know, he earns enough for it, for him to know it comes with the job. So he's earning the money to be able to
£8 million a year, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, for £8 million a year, I would happily accept some criticism. You know,
I'd do it for a lot less in my job, but let me tell you that.
I'd do it for £7 million.
Fair enough. Now, but we've all good points, but Joe Keg Liardi, I think that's pronounced, has tweeted in saying, "Surely, guys, if we sign a top centre-back and DM in Jan, all our problems could be solved, or are our issues deeper? But you say in January, just round the corner, we go out, we get a top-class centre-half. We get this defensive centre midfielder we wanted for season after season after season. Could that turn our fortunes around, Kevin?"
It does depend on the individuals concerned, but on the principle that...
If they're top draw players, two top draw players in those positions...
Well, if they're players that can shape up the team and run the team on the field, it's certainly possible, yes. I mean, if you get the right personnel in who will effectively take over the manager's role in terms of the tactics and the setup, the organisation, the focus, the motivation... Because the motivation is rarely there. You know, it's come sporadically. You know, occasionally in a match, we might, towards the end, see a burst of energy and real at it. And you think, where the hell did that come from? You know, because I haven't seen that for 65 minutes. You know, yes, it is possible that team... Because fundamentally, my argument has always been that out of that group of players... you could get more. You know, I don't think we've got a bad group of players. We're a little light at the back. There's no issue there. Okay, that's a big mistake. Everyone acknowledges that. It is basically professional negligence to start the season with six defenders. I mean, it's a no-brainer to anyone except the manager. But the point is that I think you give that bunch of players to a motivator, an in-game tactician, an organiser, someone who will prepare them for each individual match, and you would see much better results. So, yes, to answer that point, it's certainly possible, even with Wenger as the manager, that the team can improve and challenge. But they've got to be the right signings. They've got to be very strong leaders who know the game and will basically run their colleagues on strings until they get into the habit of a decent shape, especially when we haven't got the ball, doing the right things. More people need to be balled out. There isn't enough of that in the team. So it's possible, yes. We don't need to give up hope. Having said that, why didn't we get these players last summer?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very good point, because I think practically everybody realised we needed another central defender and defensive midfielder last summer, apart from Arsene Wenger. And, you know, we mentioned his salary before. You know, we all know that without earning £8 million a year and having over 30 years experience in management, which he likes to point out to people who dare to criticise him, that he has. But I take Kevin's point about, even if we bought those two players, I wouldn't be as confident as I would if we had another player, because Kevin's right. We do have a lot of good attacking talent in the team. And dare I say, I reckon if Sam Allardyce and Tony Pulis were Arsenal's manager, we would have more points on the board with exactly the same set of players as we have now than we have having Arsene Wenger as manager.
Last week in a podcast, Bernard, I felt like topping myself. After that comment, I feel like topping the whole world. But yeah, I think you've got a very good point.
It's actually a huge condemnation of Wenger to say that we'd have more points under Tony Pulis or Sam Allardyce. If you support Wenger and you actually believe that is true, then you've got to examine why you think the way you do.
Go on.
I was going to say, I think Kev's made a couple of really, really good points there. I mean, one of them being, ultimately, you look on paper, we've got a very good squad, I think. Yeah, we are short at the back, but generally we've got a very good squad. But I don't think you can shout at these players. It must be the instructions they're given from the manager. I mean, how many times have you been at work, you have a big meeting, and the boss says, right, you guys are doing X, Y, and Z, and you stand up and go, yes, boss, of course we will. And you walk out of that meeting room, and in your head, you're shaking it, saying, he hasn't got a fucking clue. And I think that's what it is. I mean, you never see Wenger at any other team. So he doesn't do what Rodgers and Mourinho and managers like that do, and they know who they're playing, and they adjust their game slightly to manage what's going to be thrown at them. Now he's just thinking, no, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Do you actually know any of the Chelsea players we're playing against this week? Yeah, it's Ruud Gullit and Zola. It's fine. it's an inept manager. The players are good enough, but the way in which they are told to play by the manager is a square peg and a round hole.
My word. Last question then, before we get to the what I call fun questions. Why, we have 10 minutes of fun in this podcast if it kills me. Aaron Ramsey had a couple of messages about him. He's played over 200 games for us now. Is he in his seventh season? Is he a half-season wonder, Bernard?
No, I think he is potentially an outstanding player. He has only had one good season last year, which was last season, obviously.
Which was injured for a lot of it, yeah.
He was injured. This season, he has been absolutely dismal, apart from the goal at Stoke, and a couple of other goals as well. But he's been dreadful. I think he would be the first person to admit that as well, because even after he got a goal at Everton earlier in the season, he said himself he didn't play well at all. So I admired that, and I think he would admit that he's had a really, really poor season. I think the part of the problem is with him is that he can't pass the ball like Zidane, but he has tremendous energy. And he's very good at breaking into the area and getting shots onto scoring goals. And those two qualities are not really what he's been used for this season. You know, I mentioned he can't pass the ball like Zidane. To me, he's playing like the creative central midfielder, pinging the ball around like Liam Brady used to. It's just not Aaron Ramsey's game. His game is getting all over the pitch, because he has similar energy levels to, Thomas Müller at Bayern Munich, and breaking forward and scoring, which he's also very, very good at. He isn't a brilliantly creative passer of the ball who can create chances out of nothing. And it seems to me like that's what he's been trying to do this season. So it isn't working. I would have a lot more faith in Ramsey getting back to his best if he actually started doing what he's best at. And that's Wenger's responsibility as well, to make sure that happens.
It all comes back to the man, Wenger. Now look, it's nearly Christmas. We can't be depressed all Christmas, and it's time for some festive fun here at the Gooner Podcast. We are going to finish on a festive high. So think back, panellists, if you can, and they haven't been pre-warned here. In this country, there's no mid-season break. for Christmas time is football, football, and more football. Are there any special festive football-related memories that you've had? Special games? Ones that you've really kind of enjoyed for that reason? Start with you, Kevin. Any festive memories?
I think I might be wrong on the date, but I'm going to have a stab at it anyway. I think it was the 23rd of December 2001. And if I'm completely out, forgive me. But Arsenal went to Liverpool. Van Bronckhorst was sent off after about 15 minutes for something completely innocuous. We were up against it and went 1-0 down. However, the Arsenal rallied, and I think Henry scored one goal, but Ljungberg, I think, got the winner. And the sight of Freddie running in front of the Arsenal fans at the away end, it was a special festive memory, and I think it was a wonderful moment.
Do you enjoy football over Christmas, Kev? Would you like to keep it, or do you have a mid-season break?
Well, there's two sides to this. Okay, if we have this September to May season, yes, we'll have it. However, I am a big advocate of summer football. I hate freezing my nads off in the middle of the bloody winter, and I think we should start in March and end in September, frankly, because no right-minded soul should be going anywhere when the temperature's threatening to touch zero and it's peeing down with rain.
Especially if you've got some goodness to sell, Kevin, outside the stadium.
It makes it hard work in these conditions, I tell you.
David, festive frolics and fun for you.
I remember one year we were playing Wolves at home on Boxing Day, I think it was. I remember this was back at Highbury. I was
Paul Ince was playing for Wolves.
It was.
I tell you what, that was the day of the tsunami. Because I drove back, I was actually in the Midlands of that Christmas, and I had to get up damn early to get down to the stadium. And that I was just listening on the radio to that tsunami story. So that game against Wolves, which I think we won 5-1. Always to me brings back that morning and listening to the horrors on the radio.
My word, once again, Kev, bring it down.
sorry, folks.
David, back to your anecdote.
But having said that, think you're going to have a nicer Christmas than that.
Thanks, Ebenezer Witcher. It's brilliant. it was half time. We were 2-0 up. About 2 minutes before half time, we're defending at our end just in front of the North Bank. I was about 5 rows back. And there was no atmosphere in our ground at that point because I could hear everything going on the pitch. And you've got Vieira, who was running the team at the time, and he was yelling at people where to stay in the box. And he turned around to Gilberto, who was supposed to be on the near post, and he was like, Jim, in the fucking stand, they hear me, Jim! And then there was a spot of laughter. And Gilberto still didn't hear him, still gripping on the post with his right hand, didn't move anywhere. Thankfully, I think it was Campbell, cleared the corner with his head. But it's interesting to hear Arsenal players speak.
It is, David. And would you give up football over Christmas? Or is it a vital part of the English tradition?
I'll go public and say I'll happily give it up because it's a pain in the arse. But if I didn't have it, I'd miss it straight away.
Bernard, we're finished with you. Your festive memory.
Yeah, easy one for me. Another 23rd of December, this time 1978, the 5-0 win at Tottenham. I still remember that goal by Liam Brady because my memory of it is, if the net hadn't got in the way, the ball would have hit me in the face. So.
And you were there, obviously, but that very reckoning. So, yeah, you were right behind the goal, yeah?
Yeah.
Amazing. Doesn't get much better than that, really, does it? And last tweet, Davey Boyd. Was there a delivery of Chinese food in tonight's pod? Well, not before, but we did have a Chinese meal beforehand. David, what did you have?
I had a Szechuan duck with sweet and sour chicken balls.
Bernard?
I had duck wrapped in pancakes.
Nice. Kev?
Singapore fried vermicelli.
Look at that. That's how diverse this panel has been tonight. Fantastic. But that's it for today, really. But before we finish, Guna Red Kevin, as you know, is in the house. He'll be one of our panelists for tonight. And that's me getting street for the kids. And he wants to entertain you all with news on what's in the current issue of the Guna. So over to you, Kevin.
Thank you, Mark. It is our calendar issue. So there's a free 16-page supplement inside, which you pull out, and it becomes your calendar for 2015. And this year we've got something a bit special. It's an Arsenal art calendar with contributions by a number of Arsenal artists who come under the Arsenal Operation Art, or no, Operation Arsenal or something. OpR.com, I think it is. Anyway, have a look on the website. There's plenty of details about it there, but it's a beautiful thing of beauty and a little extra bonus. The issue itself, a lot of reminiscence, actually. After the previous one, we've deliberately dissuaded writers from writing about Arsene Wenger as much as possible. So there's only one specific Wenger article, apart from our columnists, and a lot of retro stuff, especially part two of Amy Lawrence's interview about the Invincibles, which is fascinating reading. £2.50, it's on sale outside the stadium for the forthcoming home matches against Newcastle and Queen's Park Rangers, and probably the FA Cup against Hull, as I doubt the Princes will be working over New Year. And please support us and to buy one. It's well worth your £2.50.
And an ideal Christmas present on subscription, Kevin, I imagine, as well.
I think it would be the perfect gift, Mark.
A perfect gift for any gooner out there. Now, don't forget, you can email us. And is it goonapodcast@gmail.com?
It is.
Excellent, I remembered it. Fantastic, back of the net. And our Twitter account is @goonapodcast. So please do tweet away, email away, and as promised, next month David Udo will be doing the Snapchat page and he will be getting naked in every single picture. So if that's an appeal to you, I don't know what will.
You can see his new tattoo.
Oh yeah, seriously, he has got a new tattoo. And very good it is too for you tattoo fans out there in podcast land. Anyway, thank you very much to you, David.
Thank you very much.
Bernard.
Pleasure, thank you.
Kevin?
Festive greetings to all.
Exactly. Have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas. Let's hope for as many points as possible. But that leaves just one thing to do before we go.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee. All good friends and jolly good company. Way! Hey!